como la señorota Tío Caimán.
De repente el territorio
Tío Caimán
de sur a norte se abrió.
Tío Caimán,
la parcela que ahí está.
Welcome to the 4 o'clock hour. You are listening to KPFK 90.7 Los Angeles and Santa Barbara's 98.7. Today, this is Voices from the Frontlines segment, and we have Eric Mann and Cynthia Rojas and myself, Manuel Criollo, co-hosting today's show. Today's show, we will follow up our sort of post-elections impressions of the elections in El Salvador. First off, we're going to have James Petras, professor and a frequent writer for the Monthly Review and, you know, an eminent expert in Latin American issues. And then directly from El Salvador, we will have Zoila Quijada. She is a national delegate to the FMLN and also the head of organization in El Salvador. So that is going to be the show for today. I guess I sort of want to start off the show because me and Cynthia just came back from El Salvador, spending almost 2 weeks there. And for both of us, it has been a very transformative trip to have made and had played our role as international observers in these last historical elections in El Salvador. For me, I guess, and for Cynthia, many of you will have a chance to read our dispatches and report backs from El Salvador if you go to our website in the Bus Riders Union. It's www.busridersunion.org, and where we wrote two dispatches from El Salvador describing, you know, and reporting on the elections, both pre-elections and then post-elections. And for myself, there's three main things that I sort of learned. One was, for me, living almost all my entire life in the United States, was, you know, the impressiveness of the left in El Salvador as a mass question. It's a real thing. In other words, when there was an election between ARENA and the FMLN, many people understood that these were two distinct systems. It was not just two distinct parties. In other words, it's not like Democrat and Republican inside the United States. It's basically one party that wants to have, you know, move forward with neoliberal politics to liberalize their economy, to get closer ties to the United States. And you had another party that was essentially having and pushing forward a national program to basically reconstruct the national bourgeoisie, if you want to say, inside El Salvador. And yes, and also at the same time pushing for a sort of massive influx of social programs for the most impacted by the last, you know, 500 years of what El Salvador has suffered. And so for me, that the FMLN has been able to move from a guerrilla movement to an electoral party that has, at this moment, controls the National Assembly, controls some of the major cities in El Salvador, some of the major municipalities in El Salvador, was very impressive. In other words, that it's not just some small party out there having no sort of push on the social movement. The social movement has both a push on the party, and the party also has a large influence on the social movements. So that's the first impression. The second for me is that that this was also at the same time, even though it was very impressive, we sort of had to say, objectively, the FMLN lost these elections. And that is a truth that the FMLN, and I think the left in general, has to address, that this was a loss for the left in El Salvador. And if the election is a tactic where the FMLN was only able to win 37% of the vote, how do you win the next 14 points if your tactic is to win the elections? If we look at what did Lula have to do to win, and how do you also break some of the historical divisions inside El Salvador? In other words, in El Salvador, there's always been a very divided country and society between a clear left and a right. And what are the margins that you, what are the tactics that you have to push forward to win? So for me, there's more questions about if the objective is to win, what are the things that the FMLN had to do to figure out how to win? And third, you know, for me, coming back to El Salvador, from El Salvador, and as you read our second dispatch from me and Cynthia, we think that the question for us here in the United States, even though there's interesting debates about what the FMLN should do in El Salvador, the more interesting debate is, what are we going to do here in the United States, given that the role of the Bush administration and what they call it in El Salvador, the campaign of fear, la campaña de miedo, where they threaten remittances and they threaten the massive deportation of Salvadoreños, emboldened by and pushed forward by some of the major players in Latin America for the Bush administration. The defeat of Bush in the United States is going to be sort of a centerpiece for us, and that is basically what we're calling, that we need to defeat Bush, and if we're going to defeat Bush, it is going to be have to be a vote for Kerry. And at the same time, we know very well that the day, if Kerry is elected, that we're going to have to fight him on the occupation of Iraq, we're going to have to fight him on the Central American Free Trade Agreement, given that he is pushing forward for that, and a variety of other issues. But at this moment, for the FMLN and many forces in the world, the central question is the defeat of Bush. So those were some of our, you know, early impressions, and we're planning to write one third dispatch to give us sort of a time to reflect on, you know, how to have a full analysis of what happened in El Salvador. And so what we have online right now is James Petras, and Eric will move on to do an interview with James and his impressions of the elections in El Salvador.
Hi, Jim Petras, you on the phone?
Yes, Eric.
Great to hear from you. Very impressive body of work over many, many years. I thought before we get to the specifics of El Salvador, you could maybe try to frame the dilemma of guerrilla warfare versus and electoral warfare, and the dilemmas of whether it's the Partido Trabajador in Brazil, or in this case the FMLN in El Salvador, is the dilemma when how does the left build majority parties and majority elections? And maybe you could talk a little bit briefly about Lula and any thoughts you have about Brazil, and then segue into your, you know, sort of instant analysis or post-game analysis of the elections in El Salvador.
Well, first thing, I think the alternatives, Eric, are not elections or guerrillas. I think the big force the last decade and a half has been the social political movements in Latin America. If there's been any force that has blocked some of the privatizations and has been effective in ousting client regimes of the U.S. who have been extraordinarily abusive and selling off the most lucrative enterprises in Latin America for a song, it's been the political and social movements. Let me recount for you. In 2000, the Ecuadorian Indians and the petroleum workers, electrical workers, ousted President Marquardt, who had been threatening privatization, had not responded to Indian demands, and was effectively, the Congress was occupied as a temporary government set up for about 8 hours, and then the U.S. Clinton got on the midnight line along with the U.S. ambassador and the generals, and they ousted the popular regime. But subsequently, we had another phenomena, the Argentine uprising after 12 years of destroying the economy and finally precipitating a financial collapse and a 70% decline in living standards in 1 year. There was an uprising in Buenos Aires and the provinces. 30 people were killed. De La Rúa, the incumbent president, had to flee in a helicopter. Several other would-be presidents passed through a few days in the presidential bed. And that was has become a historical reference where the unemployed workers and the lower middle class joined together and brought about political change that none of the elected politicians and left parties and other famous electoralists were totally incapable of doing. The same thing happened in Bolivia recently. Another U.S. Puppet regime led by Sanchez de Lozada, who spoke Spanish worse than Bush, the incumbent president, was ousted as he was preparing to give away the gas and oleoducts to foreign capital on the basis of an 18% return, 82% going to the companies. And, of course, there was 82 people killed in the streets of La Paz, El Alto. A big struggle led by some of the coca farmers, the huge informal labor force in El Alto, what we call a proletarian city, mostly Indian migrants who can't find urban employment. The miners came down from the mine centers in the Sierra with dynamite sticks. Street battles, and eventually Sanchez de Lozada headed for you-know-where, Miami and then Washington, to get debriefed. So we can say the landless workers in Brazil have settled 350,000 families by occupying land, direct action, and demanding the constitutional right to have the land, empty lands, subsidized and agrarian reform. And if you contrast that with the electoral politics, it's extraordinarily striking. Nowhere in Latin America have electoral politicians, whether in government or out, carried out anything comparably significant in terms of blocking privatization, land reform, avoiding the sell-off of natural resources, etc. I can't think of a single country, with the possible exception of President Chavez, who, in a way, nationalized the public enterprise, the oil industry, which was controlled by a group very closely tied with U.S. petroleum interests, and sort of nationalized the public enterprise. Made it a function of social programs in Venezuela rather than buying a Citgo, the gasoline company, is where they invested $1 billion when you have 70% of the population outside the formal labor market. So that's about the only exception we have, and as you mentioned, we'll get into Lula in a few minutes. So, the guerrilla movements, what can we say? There's probably Colombia is the major place in all of Latin America, and the FARC has been there for over 40 years now. And essentially, the problem there is very little room for movements or electoral politics if you're a critic of the two-party oligarchy. And people forget that in 1984-85, with President Betancourt, the guerrillas came to an agreement a truce. And several thousand activists, militants came out of the underground and participated in the elections. Two presidential candidates were murdered. 5,000 activists were assassinated. And that move toward electoral politics was a tremendous setback. And, of course, the guerrilla leaders, Manuel Marulanda, sure shot, as he's called, 70-odd years old, granddaddy of the Jap of Colombia, I guess you'd call him. They've regrouped. They have about 18,000 regular guerrilla forces. The National Liberation Army has another 5,000, so we're talking in the 20s. They've been able to take the best shots coming from Kennedy, Johnson, down to Bush, and build a potent guerrilla force because they have deep roots in the countryside, in a country where the electoral road is closed, And the most dangerous place in the world to be a trade union leader is in Colombia. So
now, Jim, let me just interrupt a sec. So I'm here with Professor James Petras, and we're on KPFK 90.7 FM, Voices from the Front Lines at the 4 o'clock hour. Obviously, where I think a lot of this is going, Jim, is that you're arguing that the social movements, in this case the guerrilla movement and the FARC, has no alternative and is a correct tactic.
Well, it's labeled a terrorist organization, Eric. I'm not saying anything like that. I'm saying that in an analysis, its options, the options for movements looking for significant structural changes, what we call socialism, has its way severely blocked, and therefore one can understand, whether one agrees with it or not, that this probably has been, for the people that are looking for change, the most relevant course.
Absolutely. So I'd like you to maybe move to El Salvador and say, under those historical circumstances where the armed struggle felt in some ways that it had reached a wall, that where an electoral opportunity existed, what do you think are the strengths and weaknesses of the FMLN as an experience for both national liberation to start with and a move towards socialism?
Well, 4 years ago, I spoke with a number of trade unionists. I went through the poor barrios around Salvador. I traveled around the country with peasant leaders. I lectured to peasant organizations, spoke with trade union leaders, spoke at the FMLN, read all the documents, saw all the pictures, and the conclusion I reached was that there was more reform, social concessions during the guerrilla struggle than what came afterwards. Once the peace accord was in place, all the privatizations and attacks on the popular movements took place, and as a result, there were virtually no concessions. In fact, there was an offensive, a governmental offensive led by ARENA to undermine whatever was secured. And the FMLN, in the peace accords, not only gave up the guerrilla struggle, but in large part, their linkages to strikes, I mean direct participation. They, of course, endorsed all the actions. But their main field of activity was electoral politics in parliament, formulating critiques of the government, etc. None of the activists, both in the countryside, in the cities, and worst of all in the slums, had any memory of FMLN leaders being engaged in any kind of direct action to help the movement. So when I spoke to Schaffler Handel at the time, and I mentioned to him that only 35% of the low-income people, people living in the slums, had voted, let alone voted for his party, he labeled them lumpens, that is, people ne'er-do-wells, who had no political consciousness, etc., clearly covering up the fact that the FMLN had turned its back on people who had sacrificed life and limb to keep the guerrilla movement alive and got payback time by getting the chance to vote for these parliamentarians. When I went to their headquarters, the walls were covered with lawyers, school teachers, upwardly mobile lower middle class to middle class people. Schaffler himself had an extremely comfortable house with bodyguards all over the place, because despite the peace accord, there's still assassinations. Actually, when I lectured at the Agrarian College, when we came out, the watchman told us some guys had been around our pickup. And so a comrade from the Agrarian movement went looking underneath the car. I says, well, you start it. I'll wait outside, see what happens. So I think this whole picture of the peace accords is a big step forward as opening the door for social change is absolutely not true. If you compare the situation now as far as private sector, monopoly profits, high crime rates, and the rest of it, it's very very dismal picture, despite the rhetoric that Handel uses to talk about social change. While they've been in the parliament, while they've been in the municipalities, the main source of income is families sending money back to their namesakes in the towns and villages. That's where most of the new buildings and new projects come from. So I think the FMLN reaped what it sowed. It sowed, it planted the seeds of electoral politics as a way out. It doesn't impact very much on day-to-day struggles in any effective way, creating jobs or anything else. It's given up on land reform. The former veterans of the FMLN, many of them were young kids when they got into the guerrilla movement. When they got out, they were handed a plot of land, no credit, no tools. And, of course, they never farmed. They went into the guerrillas when they were 14, sons and daughters of farmers. But when they came out, you know, they never had a chance to learn about farming. So many of them sold their lands or stayed in the army. And others took up other kind of activities, illicit or otherwise. So my appreciation of FMLN was, yes, it was the lesser evil, and in a real way that Kerry is not. I think Kerry on many issues is worse than Bush. He's attacking Cuba and Venezuela, the only countries that have carried out significant social programs in a way that puts him to the right of Bush, and he relishes this role of being hardliner, more militarist than the militarist. And I think if you start choosing lesser evil politics, you might even lean to Bush over Kerry. And I might say throughout Latin America, among the politically conscious people, the more they learn about Kerry, the more he thinks he stinks, and they have no reason to look forward to a change from one war president to another. And I think that's become clear with President Chavez, who initially made overtures, thought he was the lesser evil, and Kerry launches a virulent attack appealing to the worst people in Miami, that is the terrorist Cuban American Foundation. So I think people have gotten the message, and at least in Argentina, where I was, several big meetings in Ecuador at the Catholic University, I'd say a good three-quarters of the people there saw nothing positive in Kerry, and I don't think anybody, any reasonable person in the United States that's interested in peace, in taxing the rich, and in developing social programs has any business supporting Kerry.
Well, on that one, Jim, I'll come back and debate you. It's very good. One of your strengths is your sharpness and absence of liberalism. Let's go back to the question, though, about El Salvador. If we're arguing that a movement, I mean, basically a movement has a limited number of options for it in any historical situation, there's nothing inherently impossible about running a guerrilla war, elections, and radical social movements on the ground. All three are possible tactical options in an overall program of resistance. If the FMLN came out of the guerrilla movements, and people were willing to risk their lives to the armed struggle, why, in your view, did that not translate into radical social movements on the ground? Why didn't it lead to comparable movements, such as the landless movement in Brazil, for instance, since some of the guerrillas could have chosen that?
I think the nature of some of the guerrilla movements was very elitist. To begin with, the fellow that's most notorious is Villalobos, who now advises the paramilitaries in Colombia, who've killed about, let's say, about 15,000 people the last 3 years. He was the main military strategist for the FMLN. He saw the mass movements as transmission belts for taking power rather than as allies on an equal footing. I think the same goes for most of the other commanders. I think subsequently many of them, more than I suspected, particularly the ones that were involved in signing a peace accord, were upwardly mobile lower middle class people who saw the chance to get into parliament as returning to career options. And thirdly, I think the nature of the peace accord they signed restricted their political activity. It maintained the state apparatus, the judicial system, the civil service, or what passes for civil service. And then they signed on under the auspices of the New York Times and took an asinine picture for the New York Times, looking like a bunch of clowns with big smiles on their faces, with absolutely no basis for thinking that they're going to have a share of the budget. And anything beyond being a impotent, loyal opposition. And I think the question of how electoral systems co-opt and how the Congress and the congressional arena is an extraordinarily corrupting experience. I've seen it in Bolivia recently. I've seen it in Brazil, etc. It turns the political leaders, if they, as they call themselves, into wheelers and dealers in Congress with business people, bankers, landlords, and as the saying goes in Latin America, as one peasant leader in Brazil told me, closer to Congress, further from the people. And I think we have to understand that the Congress and the committees and the structures within, as well as its linkages to the media, has been a very conservatizing institution, divorcing the former popular leaders from responsibility and responsiveness to their base. And it's not just a question of the FMLN, it's now a question, very obvious problem in Brazil.
Well, I mean, one thing... We're going to go to break. You want to go to break in a second? We're still okay. Well, one of the things, Jim, is this, that some of the things you said are the kind of structural contradictions that those of us who have been in the movement for a long time would feel that we could say the same about East Timor or East L.A. or Venezuela or Brazil. Many of the people with whom I worked in the left movements in the United States have now gone into electoral work. Literally, word for word, what you say is they've gone from mass leaders to loyal opposition to wheelers and dealers. We've watched them hobnob with rail contractors. We've watched them, in fact, develop a certain contempt for us, those of us trying to build left movements on the ground. They lecture to us instead of talk to us. We continue to try to work with them because sometimes they can be important tactical allies. But to watch the psychological transformation of a lot of them has been a very powerful phenomenon, from even Tom Hayden, who was a very, very radical grassroots organizer, to a, at best, moderate liberal Democrat, you know, and we've seen it happen not just dozens of times, but enough to raise it to the level of theory. But still, it comes back to the fact that in El Salvador, the FMLN ran on the following things: closer ties to the Castro government and alliances with Lula and Castro, and trying to create a so-called axis of good to counteract the Bush administration. It did talk about land reform. It did talk about trying to seize what a few of the assets left in the country. It did try to talk about reconstructing a social welfare state. It did talk about the fact that the Salvadorian economy had become so integrated into U.S. imperialism that remittances were the only form of viable trade inside the industry. Tried to say that, I believe, imply a certain protectionism around protecting using tariffs against the Central American Free Trade Agreement, it did run a campaign on the issues. So leaving aside if this isn't necessarily the best opportunity, and it did run a former member of the Communist Party under significant criticism from their own allies to the right inside the front, who was tied to the armed struggle, identified with the armed struggle, and clearly was trying to signal to the people that rather than saying, like most revolutionaries do, well, let me disassociate myself. I am now, have I ever been, met Jane Fonda for coffee. I mean, they actually stuck to their revolutionary guns and tried an electoral experiment. I'm not surprised that you're critical of it. I'm a little surprised you're so dismissive.
No, I think this is the case. In 40 years of participating and observing electoral and other forms of political struggle in Latin America, the only way the left wins is when, prior to the electoral contest, there's been profound, widespread class struggle. I was there in Chile from 65 through the early 70s. And the reason Allende won was not because he was charismatic. I mean, he was a very nice doctor, not a very particularly dynamic speaker. He was like your family doctor, an elegant man who was very sincere and committed. But the reason he won was preceding that, there had been several general strikes. There was a vast land movement that had unionized several hundred thousand rural farmers, workers. There had been a tremendous amount of land occupations for urban housing. And so when the media hit, when the fear campaigns came, these were people who had gone through a struggle associated with the communist socialists and the other groups, and they weren't moved, despite the fact that 95% of the media were against Allende, because the elites were against them, the U.S. Embassy was against them, the CIA was pouring money in against them, and they still won. I'll tell you a story. It's perhaps apocryphal. One of the cleaning women, the laundry women, was working in my apartment building. I had a talk with her, and she told me at that time, the conservative Christian Democratic priests went around the neighborhood telling them that, knocking on doors and telling the women that their children were going to be kidnapped by the communists and sent to Russia. When they touched her door, she told them, when he put that across, she says, well, that's not a bad thing. She said, at least they'll get a free education, free health system there. So that kind of response can only come from people that have been in struggle. And the only way I've seen, whether it's in Brazilian countryside, and you see the gunmen and the landlords intimidating the landless workers, why is it that 90% of the landless workers voted for Lula, thinking that he was a progressive candidate, at least his past credentials indicated, despite the fact that they were under direct threat, not just words, but real gunmen and military police? And I think the difference is that when you have these kind of collective struggles and confrontations, they polarize people, and no media in the world are going to change and interpret their experience in a way other than they perceive it through their own struggles.
Well, we're going to take a break, and then I'm going to come back. We're on KPFK 90.7.
This is time for the commercial?
This is time for the commercial, Jim. We're going to, the International Proletarian Dental Society has to make a commercial here.
Okay.
And we're going to go to station break. I'm here with Manuel Criollo and Cynthia Rojas, who just returned from El Salvador and witnessed the elections firsthand. I'll be asking them some questions. We'd like you to stay on, Jim, and listen to the participate in this dialogue. So we'll take a quick break, and please come back. You're on Voices from the Frontline, the 4 o'clock segment.